This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right. What's up, everybody? This is the Western Rookie Podcast, and I am your host, Dan Johnson. Today is going to be a day where it's just me, but I'm going to talk about some of the tougher lessons learned that, and not necessarily about the spot and stocks or the actual hunting, but lessons learned that I had to learn on Western hunting the hard way. And that ranges everything that we're going to talk about today is gas in your truck, access into specific pieces of public land, backcountry, you know, like gear if you're hunting from your truck versus gear, if you're going to maybe do a backcountry spike camp, things like that. We're going to talk about supplies, physical fitness, things like that. And so that's the goal of today's episode. I am in the process of, because of my knee surgery this year, I am not doing a Western hunt, and it's actually making me think more about Western hunting because I'm not going to be able to go on it. And so I was actually laying in bed this morning, right when I woke up. For some reason, I started like reliving a lot of my mule deer hunts in Nebraska, in South Dakota, some of my elk hunts in Colorado and Idaho. And I was just like, man, when I first started this, I went out there and I didn't have any clue what I was doing. You know, I read the articles and I listened to the podcasts and I reached out to people, but you really don't know until you actually live it, right? And so that's the goal today for as far as what I'm going to talk about. Before I do that, though, I'm going to send a huge shout out to the partners of the Western Rookie Podcast. And first and foremost, we have Wasp Archery. I'll tell you this right now. I absolutely love Wasp broadheads, man. They do a ton of damage to whatever animal that you decide you want to throw one of those things at. And so if you're looking for a bigger animal like, elk, moose, you know, all of the bigger, big game animals. I think a fixed blade would be the best option. In the past, I've used a Boss 4 blade on my hunts. I know a lot of guys love the traditional sharpshooter that they have. That's a badass head. And then, for whitetails, pronghorns, and, mule deer, some of the smaller species, I've used, my favorite head is the Wasp 3-blade jackhammer, and I killed my mule deer with that. Tons of whitetails with those, so I know they work. Go check out wasparchery.com. Enter the discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Most of their heads are still manufactured in the United States, and so that's kind of badass. Next on the list is Montana Decoy. So when we're doing our spot and stalks, when we are doing our trying to get close to these animals, whether that's, you know, in flat terrain, wide open pronghorn country, or we're creeping through a deadfall up in the elk woods, these guys have a decoy for you. They're lightweight, they're packable. The fabric that they use has high definition printing, so it looks realistic, and it's very portable and toteable. So go check out montanadecoy.com for your elk, for your antelope, for your mule deer, whitetail decoys, and so much more. So go check it out. All right, let's get in it right here. Let's get in it a little bit. I got to make some adjustments to my screen so I can have two things up at one time. All right, here we go. So I can remember when I made the decision, I think it was 2014. I made the decision like, hey, I'm going to go to Nebraska and to try to chase mule deer and pronghorn. I had some family out there, and then also I got invited on a elk hunt that year. That was going to be my first elk hunt. But I had a good amount of time to, I don't know, prepare for that. Right. So I was looking and I was doing my research on what I needed to do, what kind of gear that I needed. And dude, it was brutal. Like it was brutal. I thought that I had everything I needed. My very first elk hunt in 2014, when we went to Idaho, I was wearing the wrong boots. I borrowed a tent from a buddy who is he's a backpacker friend of mine. And I borrowed a tent from him. The waterproofing did not work. So I got, soaked, and, I didn't necessarily do a quote unquote gear check. I can even remember my boots being not hiking boots. Like they looked like hiking boots, but they were like a Wolverine, that you can go to like a Tractor Supply store. They were more of a work boot and not a hiking around boot. And I believe they even had steel toes in them. So they were heavy. They were somewhat durable, but they were just the wrong boot for what I was trying to do. And so, my first experiences going out west in the higher country, higher elevation, or even in the middle of nowhere type of environments where you don't have access to a gas station, you don't have access to maybe even clean water in some of those places. So I had to learn my lesson the hard way as far as, you don't know until you live it, right? And so here's where I am going to start. And I don't know why this isn't why I started here, but I figured if you can't get to the spot, if you can't drive there or you run out of gas, you're screwed, right? And so one thing that I've always since, I had a lot of really close calls where I was coasting into a gas station on fumes, when I've been out west. I can remember going to South Dakota for the first couple times, even in Nebraska, where I was hunting private, but still it was in the middle of nowhere. And you got to know how much gas is in your car and how much you're going to use, because you keep going out and out and out, and you hit a point where you're like, oh shit, I got to go back. Right. So I'm going to give an example here. In Nebraska, I was hunting some public, and I was just kind of scouting on Onyx, and there was a road that went to the east of this gigantic piece of public land in western Nebraska, and I assumed it went all the way through to the next highway. So I had about somewhere between a half and a quarter tank of gas left. And we were about 45 miles away from this gas station. I think I had 3/4 tank going in when we left the city or the small town and headed north into this piece. And you get there and you're just like, okay, well, there's another gas station on the highway on the opposite side. But that's like 50 or 60 miles, to be honest with you. And so you're driving in there and you get to, you're looking at Onyx and you're going, okay, well, this road goes through. Well, I didn't zoom in far enough. And so as I'm zooming in, there's a river there. Well, the river has no bridge over top of it. So the road goes right up to the river and ends. And then it picks up on the other side of the river. You can see it. I could see it, but there was no bridge. There's been other examples in South Dakota where there is a bridge, but the bridge is private. And so technically you're not supposed to drive over top of the bridge. Like there's a cattle gate there. There's a fence there. It says private road. You look on Onyx, the public road stops. It becomes private. And then on the other side, it becomes public again. So how they got away with that, I have no idea. But knowing how far you are away from a gas station is very important, because running out of gas in the middle of nowhere would suck. And I've sat on a hill before in South Dakota. And this was even when I was hunting, I got permission for a short period of time on some public land in South Dakota. And I was sitting on a hill. And I was on this hill for a very long time. And I'm talking maybe 4 or 5 hours. I was kind of picking apart some terrain. And I was kind of waiting for the afternoon movement to start. And I saw one truck go down this road in 8 hours, right? And so in some of these spots, you run out of gas, you're going to have to call somebody or you're going to have to walk to a house that could be 5-10 miles away. And so ever since, so on back to that Nebraska story, we hit that road and now it becomes, oh shit, like we got to get back to this town that's 45 miles away. And I don't know if I'm going to have the gas to get there. And this was an older truck than I have now. And it was a real gas sucker. And, dude, we were probably, I want to say 3/4 of the way there. And the gas light came on in my truck. And we just kind of went silent because I was with another guy and we kind of went silent in the truck. We're like, dude, I hope we make this. I hope we make this. And luckily I slowed down. Like, it was a lot of winding up and down hills where you had to use gas to get up the hill. And then I would coast down the hill and things like that. And it got scary there for a while. But one thing that I took away from that is now when I go out west, especially when I know I'm going to be doing a lot of driving, like in mule deer country, I always bring just a small little container of gas with me that would get me another 30 miles or, you know, something like that. So that, you know, maybe 2 gallons of gas that would get me another 30 miles or something. And that is a lesson that I got very close to learning the hard way. So know your you got to zoom in. Right. So the bullet point here is know how much gas is in your truck, know how far you can get on the gas that is in your truck. And then when it comes to private roads, right, that's kind of an access thing, right? Private roads where you can and cannot go sometimes. And they do this on purpose. They know that it's a private road and they're doing that to prevent people from getting through there. To the opposite side of whether it's a big chunk of public or a river or a piece of private, whatever the case is, you got to know where the bridges are. Maybe a bridge is out, or maybe it becomes a private road and you can't access it. That's very important when you're heading out west. And I haven't, knock on wood, I haven't learned I haven't ran out of gas yet, but I definitely have learned the private road, the bridges out lessons hardcore. The opposite of that is no, just because there is not a sign there doesn't mean it's public. And just because there is a sign there doesn't mean it's private, right? And so I've had conversations with people out there who are just like, I'll tell you this, that road is public. You can drive on it. You can go on it. However, the landowner thinks it's private. Or the road is public, but the landowner thinks it's private. And so he will throw a giant fit and he'll call the sheriff and then you'll have to deal with all that. And it kind of just depends on what you're willing to go through as far as certain rules and regulations is concerned. So I kind of have always just, if it's a public road, I'm going to drive on it. And that's kind of what I've done in the past. I've heard stories about, you know, like ranchers or groups of people coming up to you and being like, that's private. And then a guy really knowing what he's doing, saying, actually, it's not. I've confirmed this with the sheriff. If you want to call the sheriff, go call him and we can talk it out right now. And that, of course, that wastes a lot of time, but at least you're proving your point that you're educated about the road that you can and cannot go on. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers.
workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Troll Co. represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Troll Co. has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Troll Co. for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Okay, here's another lesson that I had to learn the hard way. And that was, I was doing a lot of scouting on Onyx, right? And I was looking at roads and I was seeing, basically it was like what roads you can and can't go on. And then looking at some BLM, this example was looking at some BLM ground and then looking at the walk-in that was kind of connected to this BLM ground. So I was like, dude, I'm going to go somewhat deep into this BLM ground, but I'm going to take a shortcut through this private or this, not private, but through this walk-in, there. And so there was like, I don't know, we're talking like 3,000 to 5,000 acres of BLM ground, a big chunk. And then surrounding it to one side was walk-in. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. You know, yeah, I know other people can get to it, but I'm going to park on this road, there's like a little parking lot, and then I'm going to walk. So I took the time from where I was at and I drove all the way out there and I got to the road and I looked at Onyx and it said it's walk-in. Well, when I got there, there was a sign on a fence that says, this is, long story short, this is not access to public, you know, to public hunting. You know, this is not walk-in, but I think it was like 50 to 100 yards into the pasture, I saw another sign. And so I had to put my binos up and read it. And it said this, you know, from here on out, it's walk-in. So they did this on purpose, right? They didn't want people to be able to park on the road. So there's like this 50 to 100 yard buffer of private property that you could not go through. So what I had to do in order to, and I had committed to this piece for the day, right? I'd already driven all the way out here. And so I ended up having to drive way north multiple miles to an access point where this walk-in kind of touched a road. I parked there, hopped into the walk-on and then, or the walk-in, and then I had to walk all the way back to where I was going to park and essentially then hop another fence from the walk-in to the BLM. And so I don't know if they think that that was going to deter some people. I'm sure it does, but the line I had to look, I just assumed that it touched the road. And when I got out there and I zoomed in real close, I did notice that the lines for the walk-in and the lines for the private property were off-centered a little bit. And so, you know, they had to do that for a reason, I'm assuming. They don't want people on their property, but they do want to make the money for the walk-in. And so at some point, there has to be access to the walk-in to get paid to it so people can actually use it to call it walk-in. But it wasn't landlocked. The BLM was landlocked. You couldn't get to it unless you walked through the walk-in, but they made it extremely hard for you to do that. So, long story short,
you know, you got to be willing to go that extra. In this case, it would have been an extra 3 miles in, and then turned around and walked 3 miles out at the end of the hunt that night. And, you know, when I thought I was going to be able to hop a fence and walk maybe 2 miles total in the day. So instead of walking 2 miles when I got there, thinking I was going to, you know, for this morning hunt, I got there in the dark and the sun starts to come up. So I'm getting out of my truck, getting ready, and I look, can't do it. Drive up. Next thing you know, sun's up. I'm seeing deer on their feet already. The plan was to get to a knob into glass. I was just busting deer out left and right. And, it was not what I thought it was going to be. So you have to, there's a lot of those types of scenarios, and kind of even going back to private roads, right? You think you're going to be able to get into a spot, and then there's a private road. And it's like, okay, well, I have to go all the way back here to get to this piece of walk-in that connects to the public where I want to hunt. Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. So it, just be aware that those types, I don't want to call them tricks, but those types of obstacles will be in front of you if you've never done this before. And then, of course, I was able to, you know, drop pins and gather information so that the next time that I went out there, I was able to know, hey, listen, I got to go all the way around. I got to try a different access or knock on a door to try to gain access. There has been some times where there was a smaller piece and I just asked permission to walk through a pasture. Can I park in your driveway or off to by your cattle lot and walk through your property to get to the public? And they're just like, yeah, that's fine. And so I've been able to have a couple relationships like that as well, which is nice. So be aware of where the actual boundaries are. If it looks like, you know, and now Onyx and some of these other mapping apps are very accurate. So if there is walk-in and it does look like it's off center from the act, like off of whack from the public property boundaries, the private land boundaries, 100% it's there for a reason and it is accurate. So be aware that you might have to, you know, you might not able to, you know, you might not think you're going to be able to get into some of these spots, on things like that. All right. So walk in land, landlocked, the landlocked thing is real. We've all heard the corner crossing stories. And I know in the past not in the state where it's been, publicized, but I've had to do some corner crossings before. To be honest with you, I didn't know if it was legal or not. And in the past I've done it. Now I just kind of, I hunt in spots where I get to park on the public and walk in or ride my e-bike in, and it kind of helps with everything. So, be aware, right? And okay. So I'll go back. I made a little note here that I didn't talk about. So in that scenario where there was this do not, you know, like this is not walk in. And then 50 yards later, this is walk in. And I called the DNR. I had his phone number later that day. And I go, hey, listen, I'm kind of confused here of where I can and cannot go. I'm here. The guy that was the DNR officer, he's like, dude, I get 1,000 of these calls a year. He said, because of this line. They 100% did it this way. And it's just one of those things. It is what it is. If you want to hunt that property, you got to go all the way around to get into it. And so he was just like, it kind of is what it is at this point. So be prepared for that. All right. I'm going to take a sip of coffee here real quick. That was hotter than I thought. All right. Backcountry hunting. So much fun. Like hiking into a place, camping in nature, you know, cooking your meals out of a jet boil, you know, sitting there with your buddy, like the sun comes up and you're like getting prepared. You're in a tent. There's no artificial light. You can see like Colorado, 10,000 feet. You look up at the stars. You think you can touch them. The first year I ever went out to South Dakota, me and a buddy left the truck, hiked 2 miles in, set up a camp. And the stars were brilliant, and we saw a a shooting star that was just absolutely bananas. And it was just like, it's awesome. It's an awesome experience. I highly recommend that if you're young enough and you want to make it a little bit difficult, but still extra fun, backcountry spike camps are the way to go, dude. I absolutely love it. Now, here's some hard lessons learned after saying that, right? And there's going to be more than what I'm saying. I want to talk about gear real quick. First Colorado elk hunt, borrowed a tent from somebody, climbed all the way up, set up. First night, no rain, felt amazing. Boots, okay. You know, I talked a little bit about the boots, the Wolverine boots. And day one, I was like, okay, this is cool, dude. I love it. This is fun. You know, we ate our Jetboil meals. We got it. You know, we were able to sit and have this little awesome conversation as the sun's setting in the mountains, talking about life and went to bed tired and woke up. You know, I had a okay sleeping bag. I had an inflatable mat that I was using. I was tired, so I went right to sleep. Next morning, came early. We got up, went out on the elk hunt, and that's when I started to realize that my gear was not, I did not have the right gear. I did not have a backpack style of first off a pack to even get that shit in and out. Right. I had a bag that I bought from Cabela's that I'm not joking is like a school bag that I would give to my kid. I threw it away actually a couple of years ago. It was somewhat durable, but it had no support. The belt and the straps on it were like school backpack style. It was cheap. And so that's why I bought it. And so getting stuff in and out of it, like if I did shoot an elk or we did shoot an elk, I would have been completely fucked because there's no way I was packing anything out other like that had any weight to it than what I packed in. And so that would have been a nightmare if it would have happened. But that's the first thing I noticed. My pack was shit. And that next year I upgraded. However, my boots also shit. They were not hiking boots. They were factory work boots. They were construction site work boots, right? And they were okay, but they had steel toed boots in them. And so there's steel toes in them. And so like I was at this point in my life, I was trying to get away with having the most affordable gear that I could possibly have. And I learned that that's not what you want because by the end of like I was wearing those boots. They were broke in throughout the year, but when you get into the mountains and you're walking you're side hilling, you're going up and down, they just did not work. They killed my feet. And then my feet became bad. My knees became bad. My back became bad. And, it was all I was thinking about instead of trying to think about getting to elk. It was not good. Now, the other thing that I, didn't necessarily realize, and this isn't on that elk hunt, but this is again on, the first year I went out with a buddy, the second year, and it was nice. It was warm. It didn't get too cold. I was looking at the forecast. The next year I went out, I was looking at the forecast and, it said, you know, it's going to get down into the, you know, high 20s at night. And I had a 20 degree bag. Okay. And so it said the low is going to get into 30, you know, 29, 30 degrees. And there was a night or two, it was two nights where it got down to 19 degrees and my sleeping bag did not cut it. And there is absolutely nothing worse than being cold and not being able to sleep in, on a backcountry hunt like that. I was comfortable. My inflatable mattress was good. My sleeping bag was comfortable. I took a hooded sweatshirt. I used it as my pillow, but my sleeping bag was not cold enough. So in order to offset that, dude, I was wearing almost all of my camo and still in my sleeping bag. And I've done a little bit of reading where maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe I actually should have reduced some layers and went skin to sleeping bag. And that way my body heat would have maybe kept me more warm in a scenario like that. I'm not 100% sure, but, know the temperatures out there, because I think it was two nights in a row that I committed to being that far out, and I did not want to walk 2 miles back to my truck to sleep in my truck and then walk 2 miles back in the morning, and potentially blow out deer that were moving around and in. So I was in a really good spot. I was next to a really good, glassing point. And so I wanted to make sure that, I was there. And so I dedicated two nights to a sleeping bag that sucked. And then, so when the sun came up and the sun started to hit me and I started to warm up, I wasn't shivering, I got tired. And so there was parts of the day where I was sleeping in some shade tree or shade bush that was out there instead of glassing for mule deer movement. And yes, I saw some okay mule deer movement, but I was so tired that I was falling asleep. I was so tired. I didn't have the energy to really want to go chase them. I was zapped for energy, and it kind of cost me, 2 days worth of hunting. Now that third day that I was in there, it warmed up. I slept way better, but then I had another issue that kind of popped up. It was cold at night. You're shivering. Essentially the shivering and the coldness is zapping water out of your body. Okay. Then it's hot and windy and dry throughout the whole day. So whether you know it or not, the moisture is coming out of your skin. It is dehydrating your body. The wind is doing it. The dry air is doing that. And so I start drinking more water. Okay. And I realized that, and I did not pack enough water to be in there. And I thought I packed enough. So I, again, had to make the decision. Am I going to filter this water, or am I going to run back to the truck to get crystal clear drinking water that I bought at a store? And I decided that I wanted to stay in again because I didn't want to hike the two and a half miles out to go to my truck and then turn around and hike another 2 miles, 4 to 5 miles round trip just to get water. So I went to some puddles that were there, and the water was clean, but it kind of smelled a little funky, right? This is a area where there's cattle in this area all summer long. And then I believe by September 1st, they have to move all of the cattle out of this area. And then that's kind of when the deer kind of come back into it. And so there's, cattle runoff and things like that. I had a filter, and I also had iodine pills, right, to clean the water. And so I made a decision where I filtered it, and then my filter busted. Okay. And I don't know how it busted. It was like a pump. You put the tube in and I pumped it by hand, and then that would go into my bladder. I was halfway through it, and I don't know if it was a seal that broke or a hinge that broke on it. And now I don't have any way to get clean water through this filter. So I took my Nalgene bottles and I dipped it in the clean water, and I put my iodine pills in it. And so I had to wait what was like 3 hours or 4 hours to even use that water. And I had to kind of save some water back at camp, so I had enough to drink when I got back to camp, and clean, cook with. So there was 2 days of that. And I didn't get sick because I had the pills that clean the water. But the pills don't filter out the sediment. They don't filter out the flavor per se. And so I was basically drinking sand water in a scenario like that. It was clean water, but I didn't have enough of that. And because I'm exerting a lot of energy that I didn't think that I was going to, because it was hot out, right? Then at night you start to relax and then your body gets hungry. And I'm looking at my, you know, my bars that I brought in. I'm looking at my Jetboil meals that I brought in, my freeze-dried meals that I brought in. And I go, I don't think that I have enough like daily snack food. I have enough of my end of day Jetboil meals that I've been making, but I've been eating more because I've been exerting more energy. I've been drinking more because I've been exerting more energy, and the environment is beating the shit out of me. And I was not prepared for any of that. And so I had to like say to myself, dude, you can't eat this bar until tomorrow. And I was starving. Like I was hungry. And so I started to like, from an energy standpoint, it started to like wither away. Like I said to myself, okay, I can't eat this now. I'll just get to a point and I'll start glassing and I'll just glass more and I won't move around as much more. Well, that doesn't solve any problems. That doesn't make the deer, like reserving your food doesn't make the deer get closer to you. And so the lesson that I kind of learned here was I was trying to hunt like I was an advanced backcountry hunter. I was trying to be minimal in what I was bringing in. And over the course of the next handful of years, I realized that I needed to bring in like more weight, right? For me and my body style, I needed to consume more food and I needed to consume more water. Because there were some times in my first couple Western trips, especially elk hunting in higher elevations, where my pee got really yellow really fast to the point where it was getting like brownish, really dark brownish yellow. And I was dehydrated. I was getting headaches. And so I kept saying to myself, like, dude, you have to bring more water in. And so knowing that I needed to bring more water in, knowing that I needed to bring additional snacks throughout the day, kind of led me to train different. And it wasn't just like this physical fitness, like go lift weights. It kind of changed how I train from, I just put weight on my back and I go hike around a lake now, right? Because the more, like, the better you are at that, the more you're going to be able to bring in and bring out, and your legs and body will be conditioned for that. Yes, the burpees. Yes, you know, having a good solid core. Yes, all of that stuff is very important. But for me and the way that I've trained to prepare for a Western hunt now is literally put on a backpack, put on some weight, and go hiking around a lake. And that's what I've been doing the most. That is what has helped me. And then when I go into a higher elevation hunt like elk, then I'm putting a little bit more weight on my pack and I'm trying to burn the legs out. There's nothing that prepares you for the higher elevation, but the more your muscles are conditioned, the easier it will be. It's still going to be hard. But imagine just lifting weights like what I did. All I did was lift weights, got bulky, went in. I wasn't lean. I went in heavy and muscular, and muscles take oxygen. And when you got bigger muscles at higher elevations, your body's going to use more oxygen. And, it sucked, dude. It was brutal. And then when I changed that, the next couple elk hunts I went on became easier and easier. The first hike up in the morning always sucked. But when I was moving around up in the high country, you know, like 10,000, 11,000 feet, I was like, dude, it sucks, but I feel better than what I did in previous years because I changed my diet. And I changed my, I was consuming more calories, which was awesome. I was consuming more water, which was awesome. I had a physical fitness plan in place that allowed me to be mobile, more and for it to suck less. And I'm really kind of concerned of how my body is going to react after this knee surgery that I've had and this knee replacement surgery. Obviously, nothing, you know, it's not going back to normal. I'm going to have to put in a little bit more work to get my body in the next year and a half, basically ready for my next Western hunt. But the fitness thing, I can't tell you how important it actually is. Like, I don't know how to say this. Like, if you're obese or if you're fat and you think you're just going to walk out, even into lower elevation, Western South Dakota to hunt a mule deer with a rifle, like, unless you're on private land and you got a side-by-side where you're going to run right up to it, if you plan on doing any type of backpacking or walking in, dude, I'm telling you, get your shit together, because it's not going to work that way, right? I've been through it. I've seen the deer on the next drainage and didn't go chase them because I didn't have the energy to go chase them, right? When I started implementing a fitness plan into my Western hunting strategy, I went and started chasing them, and I got close, right? And then the year I ended up shooting my deer is because I decided to go back another drainage. We decided to cross a big drainage and go into the next drainage, and that's where they were at. So it's something that you definitely need to think about. I also tweaked my strategy a little bit to where I have an e-bike now, right? So this e-bike allows me to do some pretty creative things on the public land where the public land allows it, right? And just because for example, I can't use it in walk-in, but I can use it on BLM in certain states, right? Every state and every area is a little bit different, right? I have an e-bike. There's rules and regulations about e-bikes and side-by-sides and where you can go and where you can't go. In some of the grasslands, it's crazy. In some of the grasslands, I'm not allowed to use a two-vehicle, like a dirt bike or a bicycle even, or an e-bike, because they feel the two wheels create erosions, right, or whatever. That's the rule. I can drive my truck on this property, but not my e-bike. Blows my mind, but it is what it is. It's the law. So I've been tweaking my strategy of, you know, hunting out of my truck in the past, and knowing how many supplies I have in my truck. Obviously, when you're hunting out of your truck or sleeping in the back of your truck, you have almost unlimited supplies, right? You can load your truck up with food and water. Every year I go out west, I buy like 10 to 15 individual gallons of drinking water just to keep in my truck. And it's crazy because I go through it. And then of course, if you're at a cabin or a campsite and you're going back there every day, you know, supplies aren't really an issue. At that point, foot care is an issue, right? If you get a blister, I've had blisters, and how you take care of your blisters, the right boot sock combination fixes some of that problem. So, and again, just because you're listening to this episode doesn't mean that you are going to say, okay, Dan, well, I have the sleeping bag now, and I got, it's a negative 20 degree bag, and now I'm problem solved. It's not like that. Some of these lessons you have to learn the hard way, especially the physical fitness one, how much water you do or do not take in, or food you do take in on a backcountry type hunt. These are just things that I've had to learn the hard way, and I wanted to share with you guys today. If you guys have any questions, right? I don't necessarily communicate through the Western Rookie Instagram page that much, but I do communicate through the Nine Finger Chronicles page quite a bit. So if you have any questions about upcoming hunts or do's and don'ts, I'm not going to write giant paragraphs because I have a lot of these to respond to every day, but I'll give you some. I would be okay with giving you some short pointers, or, you know, if you had any advice, if this is your first ever Western hunt for mule deer or elk or pronghorn, or what your public land strategy is, I'd be willing to type up something real quick for you guys if that's what you want. So feel free to reach out to me there, and I'll see what I can do. Outside of that, if you guys could do me a huge favor, subscribe to the Western Rookie. Leave some comments about how you like this podcast. 5-star review would be awesome. And then also know that I do have the Western Rookie podcast on YouTube as well. So, outside of that, Yeah, that's it. So we didn't cover weapon. We didn't cover like what to do if your bowstring snaps or if you run out of ammo or if, you know, you jam dirt in your scope breaks or something like that. We didn't talk about that, like the actual hunting supplies. Basically I wanted to talk about everything but that. And so maybe the next episode we do, maybe I'll get a guest on and we'll talk a little bit about what to do if you break a cam or if you accidentally dry fire your bow 45 miles or 100 miles from the nearest bow shop or some shit like that. So another conversation in the future about these things. For those of you who have kind of stuck with this Western Rookie brand, I know we've had a couple hosts changes over the course of the last couple of years. I really do like this podcast. I really love hosting it, and I want to continue to host it. So thank you very much for sticking with me. And I hope everybody is now in the planning and preparation stage for your upcoming Western hunts this fall. Good vibes, everybody. And we will talk to you when we talk to you.